Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Old Brother. In this episode we'll be speaking to someone who, as well as being a successful musician, is also a Grammy nominated and Gold Disc earning producer, who's known for working extensively with Billy Bragg and the Smiths. More relevantly for this show, he worked with the Fall off and on for much of their existence, both as live soundman and as producer, starting with Dragnet in 1979. Okay, this is episode 2 of Old Brother, the Fall podcast, with me and the legendary Stephen Hanley. And this is the first one we've got where we've got an actual guest today. Now, Steve, you need to be careful here because this guy's very shy. So, let him get a word in edgeways. Yeah, because he doesn't say a lot. Encourage him to speak, because you don't get a lot of talk out of this guy. So without further ado, I'll introduce it, and here he is, Mr. Grant Cunliffe Showbiz of this parish. How are you, Grant? Are you okay?
I'm all right. How's it going up there in the north?
Yeah, we're still there getting out of the bath to have a piss, you know. We're doing all right, yeah. So, it must have been a bit weird for you at the moment, this. Without getting out there and playing live.
I have to say that I've been pretty much living off all the cancelled tickets that I bought to go to shows. There seems to be about,
refunds
that I went to, and they've all been gradually coming back to me.
Yeah. Right, so we're supposed to talk about the Fall then, really. So, the first thing I was going to ask you, Grant, is how you got into this world of show that we call show business. You started off with Gong, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough to be around sort of at the very beginning of the first bands that I kind of followed with Bowie. And I was around in that sort of period just pre-Ziggy Stardust, when Bowie was about to break big. And so he did a lot of live gigs around where I lived, which is Hemel Hempstead, Dunstable, Aylesbury. He seemed to keep coming back out to those venues and playing them, and indeed bringing people like Lou Reed out with him and stuff like that. So I got a bit of a taste for that. And, of course, in those days, he already had his bodyguard, who I think was called Stu, which is a fantastic thing to have because there weren't that many people at the gigs, but he had a bodyguard. We got to meet me and my best mate, who became involved with the woman who was running the Bowie fan club. We got to meet Bowie a few times and, you know, get some glitter off him and some drumsticks off Woody and all that kind of shebang. And so getting a little bit of a taste for, you know, breaking whatever they call it, that wall between the performer and the attendee. And then in the midst of all this, Gong came along.
It's a big bit of a leap.
But what I'm saying is that I was probably listening to Bowie and Gong at the same time, and I'd made the sort of contact with Bowie. So when Gong came along, the idea of then going off back after the gig and saying hello to them
was much easier. Yeah.
And of course, they did a really interesting thing, because obviously dear old David and particularly Lou Reed definitely kept us at arm's length. You know, they were happy to chat, but they weren't going to put their arm around you and give you a cuddle. I remember with Lou Reed, he was touring with a band called The Tots.
Right.
They were very short-lived, kind of post-New York Dolls. Well, probably exactly the same time as the New York Dolls band. And I remember handing over the first Lou Reed solo album to have it autographed by Lou. And he handed it back, and I said no, I want the Tots autographs as well. So he was kind of a bit grumpy about that. grabbed the album out of my hands and wrote The Tots on it and gave it back to me.
Bloody hell!
So they weren't that friendly. Oh. But of course, dear old Gong got chatting to them again, probably after a gig at Aylesbury, and it turned out that they lived in Oxford.
Right.
And you know, in those days, I was hitchhiking I would hitchhike to the gigs and hitchhike back again, and I was sort of like, well, I'm off to hitchhike now. No, they said, oh, we'll give you a lift. We're going that way.
Right.
So, you know, from meeting these kind of amazingly strange, bizarre people.
Yeah.
Very quickly, they kind of said, oh, do you want a hand? And we'll go back. And then I got to know the farm that Virgin, because Virgin were you've got to remember that Gong and Mike Oldfield were the first releases.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Virgin had as much idea that it would be Gong that would make their millions as it would be Mike Oldfield would make their millions. So they were being quite, they were looking after their artists quite a lot. So they had a farm in Whitney,
right,
which is where the wonderful Conservative MP who took us out of the common market lived. His name escapes me at the moment. So it's a groovy little farm, and therefore I then suddenly started doing regular trips up and down the country to see Gong and getting to know them pretty well. And, you know, Virgin would hire a coach and we'd go out with...
Wow.
Sometimes we went out with Kevin Coyne, we went out with Hatfield and the North. We went out with a film of Tubular Bells at one point, I remember. And so I was getting pretty matey with the band. And yeah, then somewhere along the line, they...
Were you helping them out at this time? Were you roadie in, so?
No, I wasn't roadie. No. I was merely the guy backstage. You know, I'd turn up for the sound checks and give my incredibly valid opinion about how the gig had went. I can remember very clearly going backstage and everyone would be moaning about how bad the gig was. And I'd be like, it was the best gig I've ever seen. But, you know, I was hitchhiking up to Sheffield and things like that. So I wasn't doing anything to do with them. And eventually I got wind, and I don't quite know how this happened, but there was a guy from Here and Now who was then being sort of trained up by Steve as a kind of roadie.
Steve Hillage, that would be.
And that was what happened. Yeah, Steve Hillage. So he kind of, the guy who was doing it, who was called Twink, but isn't the guy who plays drums in the Pink Fairies, but is a synthesizer player who played with Here and Now.
Yeah, not the famous Twink.
No, not he's the less famous Twink. always been the bane of his life, really. But I ended up being told, and I don't know how this happened. Maybe it was just Steve told me this guy, you know, Steve and Miquette, who I got quite friendly with and I was hanging with and often sleeping at, you know, I was often sleeping at the farm
right
by then, and then getting up the next morning and hitchhiking home if we got home really late. I mean, you know, we were doing things like we'd go, because the Manor studio was just round the corner, so often we'd turn up, get back from a gig in Sheffield or wherever, and go to the Manor House recording studios and just literally eat the entire contents of their fridge and then carry on back to the farm in Whitney. But yeah, Steve sort of said, oh, this guy's gone, do you fancy coming along? And I suppose this was probably, I want to say it's after Fish Rising. It was either during Fish Rising, which is the first Steve Hillage solo album, certainly before the second album, because Steve started teaching me how stereos worked and
right,
how to solder things. And in fact, I learned more about the technical side of music, and I was better at it then than I've ever been since. It's all gone now.
He was quite the teacher, wasn't he, Steve Hillage? I mean, he's a good, hell of a producer, done some stuff.
Yeah, he went on to do some amazing stuff, and he did, you know, he had a very... He could explain electronics to me, and he was very patient with things. And then eventually, when they were going to the second album with Todd Rundgren in America, they had to move. They were by that time they'd kind of split from Gong, and they were moving their stuff out of Whitney. And I had a basement in my family house, and they wanted to stash a lot of gear there and then pick it up when they came back. So I then, you know, they then transported all their gear over to my house. They went off to America, and I was really pleased with that because Todd Rundgren was someone I really loved.
Yeah.
And then they came back, and I think around about 76, 76 was the first actual gig I did with Steve. I mean, it was great. Pre that, I'd been working out of Virgin Management and sort of helping to sort of get the players that were going to be in Steve's band. So Steve had a list of people like Mitch Mitchell from Jimi Hendrix, Jimi Hendrix, a series of bass players, a series of synthesizer players. And they kind of took me down to Robert Wyatt's cottage somewhere down in the West Country, which is where they moved to. And then they got me in. They got in a synthesizer player who had a called Basil Brooks, who had a house in Notting Hill Gates. I was staying there, and I was going in every day to Virgin Management. and phoning up people like, you know, Clive Bunker from Jethro Tull and saying, do you fancy coming and doing an audition with Steve Hitch?
Yeah.
And, you know, getting a date together. Same thing with Mitch Mitchell. We took over a rehearsal room that was called Manticore in Fulham Road, which is a huge old cinema. And I have incredible memories of Mitch Mitchell coming down and obviously being a little bit spacey and probably a little bit too jazzy for what Steve wanted. But then when they'd done the audition, Mitch Mitchell then sat at the drum kit and probably played drums by himself for about 2 hours.
Oh,
I just sat in the room listening to him. It was like a little bit like I thought, oh, he hasn't got a drum kit anymore.
Yeah.
And he hasn't got anywhere to play. And he just wants to have a good time. You know, it was quite an awesome thing. So it was really weird. So here I was...
Can't have been very old. How old were you then?
I was 19.
Bloody hell.
And I was already kind of, you know, phoning up all these people that, you know, like the synthesizer player from Arthur Brown's Kingdom Come or whoever these people were. And gradually we put together a band. I mean, Steve and Mick Hetcher chose all the band members eventually. And then we played our first
ever. And who was the drummer then?
It was Clive Bunker.
Right.
Okay.
We ended up with Clive Bunker from Jethro Tull, who needed that thud. But it was weird things like my mate who played in a sort of sub prog band in Hemel Hempstead ended up being the main keyboard player. And my friend Christian Boulay, who was an acquaintance I'd met via Gong, who was a sort of well-known French guitarist who I'd been staying with in Paris. He ended up as the guitarist. So it was kind of...
Did you ever pay any bleeding rent, you, between the years of 1970 and 1990?
Sorry, say that again?
Did you ever pay any rent in those 20 years? You seem to be staying with someone every night.
I was squatting the entire time. It was very, very... I was squatting up till... midway through the Smiths period. I reckon I was still squatting in 86, which would have been the end of the Smiths period. Or maybe
I remember going to that spot of yours, yeah. It was pretty good, actually. It was nice.
Yeah, no, so they were like high-level squats, and it was well-organised, it was an easy, I look back at it now and think it was quite an easy life, you know. So the first ever professional thing that I did was I'd gone to university and Steve had gone off to see Todd Rundgren and there was a reunion of Gong, who had then split up in Paris. And I was living in Brighton as I dropped out of university. So I guess this is, I want to say 75. Somehow, and I don't quite know how this happened, I ended up stage managing the whole event. And also we put on a coach trip from England to go to the gig. So there were like, I don't know, 50 people paid us. I don't know however much to go to this gig. And then I ended up having never done it in my life, being the stage manager for this gig where, like, you know, 20 different bands played and it went over time. It was so French. It went over time by hours and hours. And I think the coach that we booked sort of left 2 hours before the show actually finished.
Bloody hell.
So I'd had a little bit of taste of that. But eventually Steve Hillage did his first ever gig with this band supporting Queen.
Christ.
I want to say September 76 in a free gig at Hyde Park. I had a bit of an epiphany at the Hyde Park gig. There's a huge amount of people and it was kind of pretty exciting to be backstage and part of all of that. But also during the Queen gig, I decided to go out to the mixing desk on a bit of a whim, having realised that, you know, mixing desks were interesting and the people there were great for the Queen gig, having finished the Steve Hillage gig. And I think there's a version of It's All Too Much by the Beatles Hyde in 1976, which is the only song that Steve Hillage's band were recorded and videoed for then. And I went out after that to see Queen and to see what it was like and sounded like from the mixing deck. And there were kind of like quite a lot of techie people out there sort of running around and looking at things and poking at them. And then Brian Humphries, who I believe is the name of the sound engineer for Queen at that time, and he was doing a lot of other bands as well, turned up, and he was obviously a little bit squiffy. Something was making him wobble, and when he did turn up, everyone was very excited, and they started telling him about the, you know, the delay times and the compression ratios and whether the 5.5.7 was working on all these kind of things, and he kind of looked round at everybody slightly wide-eyed and pointed at his ears while they were telling him all this and said, "I've got these." And it was a kind of, it was at that moment, you know, like a lightning bolt from the sky where I suddenly thought, oh, you know, all he's using here is his opinions and his ears.
Right.
And I've got those. I've got both of those.
You are.
You know, and that maybe, I think there was a little inkling, nothing concrete, but a little inkling that I might do something like that.
Right. Right, so we've done 40 minutes. We've barely got you out of your teens here. We must get on to, we must get onto the fall at some point.
Yeah, I'm really sorry.
No, it's great. No, that's great. So, so then, obviously, you, with Steve Village in America, you end up working with Here and Now, presumably.
Well, what happened was I went and licked my wounds and went to Brighton and dropped out of university. We hung out in Brighton. And we'd crossed, Steve Hillage and me, Kat and myself had met Here and Now in the summer of 76. And they'd been, we'd gone down to a free festival called Megan Fair. And it was pretty much a disaster. No one seemed to be able to get into the, we did some jamming with them, but it didn't seem, it seemed to be a little bit of a problem with people choosing the correct key to play it. And I got a real, you know, I went away thinking, okay, they're a bit loose, and you know, Steve and Mikel aren't loose, they're tight. They, or, you know, they might seem loose to other people, but compared to Here and Now, they're super tight and they know what they're doing. Somewhere along the line, they came down to, I think I went off to a festival, and a very tiny festival. In those days, Here and Now were kind of like a festival-only band. They didn't really do proper gigs.
Yeah.
And we were somewhere called Trentishire, which is, I think, in northern Cornwall. And there were maybe, I want to say, 200 people there. And I went along, I think, as a punter. And in those days, a festival didn't have anything that we think of as a festival now. It's just a bunch of people in tents.
Yeah.
And literally, you know, they'd be waiting for Here and Now to turn up, and then Here and Now would turn up, and then they'd sit around for a week.
Yeah.
And they'd maybe do a gig if someone had built a stage and got a generator by then. So, and somehow I just got, you know, having done the Steve Hillage thing, I was a little bit like, well, I'll go and set the drums up, and then I'll carry the bass and plug that in, and then I'll put the, you know, I'll put the amplifier on stage, and then I'll talk to the to the band and say, maybe you want to do a gig, you know, and they eventually would decide to do a gig on a full moon or something like that, and then over that week or 2 weeks, whatever it was, individually they all sort of came up to me and said, do you want to be part of the band? And I was like, oh my God, they're, you know, having been discarded by my first love, suddenly here was the chance to do something else. And I think there and then I got back on the bus and went into West London and started squatting with them. You know, they were all around an area called Frestonia, which was allegedly a, you know, a free area of like of London that had declared itself independent of the UK.
Yeah.
A bit like a passport to Pimlico.
Pimlico, yes.
Right. And there I was suddenly with a bunch of people who desperately needed organising and who, unbelievably, I probably had more, you know, with my little bit of knowledge and very loud voice, had a little bit more organising abilities than they all had. And so they kind of let me tell them what to do.
Right. See, well, I always think when, you know, when you, obviously you started in the punk, I always thought that you were with Here and Now for ages before the punk thing happened, but it was pretty contemporaneous, really. Wasn't it about the same time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, I think we're talking 77. I'd met them in 76, but really, we were touring, you know, with the punk version of Gong, which called Planet Gong, which is basically Here and Now, plus David Allen and Gilly Smythe, who were the original creators of Gong. And so we were doing a kind of, a kind of punk thing. So, and I can remember very clearly hearing the Sex Pistols.
Yeah.
And this revolutionary new punk thing. And I have to remember that Steve Hillage said to me, it's a 12 bar.
Yeah, yeah.
is this the revolutionary thing?
Yeah.
It's a 12 bar blues. And I was a little bit like, oh, okay, I like the words, but yeah, he's right. And I remember listening to, at the end of the Planet Gong tour, we were in France and someone put on the Damned album. So that would have been December 76.
Yeah.
Is that right? I don't know. My time is a little bit out. But yeah, so I mean, we were pretty much started doing the Planet Gong punk thing in 77. And then what happened was myself and the drummer from Here and Now, we've been watching all that, because the punk thing happened all around us, you know, you could see Clash.
Yeah, well, you must have been right in the middle of all that going
on. We were in West London, so we could see, you know, we'd heard the damn first album. I guess that's the end of 77, is it? I don't know.
Probably a bit earlier than that, I think.
Very early 78, we went and saw Alternative TV in the 100 Club.
Right.
They were just astonishing. Mark Perry was brilliant. They did that thing where they let the audience come up and talk during the song.
So which good.
Alternatives.
The Images Cracked album, that amazing first album by Alternative TV, which seems to have sort of slipped out of view when it's actually one of the great records of that year.
I could quote that probably pretty much word for word.
I could.
There's a bunch of shit in there.
We've given you a platform, and look, what have you done? You started a fight.
Yeah. See, all I get from you is fucking Coronation Street. It's a great album.
Brilliant album. And of course, you know, what you've got to realise is that his record label, Mark Perry's record label, Rough Trade Records, were literally about a half mile from where I was squatting.
Right.
So I then took it upon myself to contact Mark and say, hey, you know, we've got a PA, we've got a band, we're doing free tours, but we really like this punk thing. Would you like to come and do a tour with Here and Now? And he was very up for it, and we did some work with him. But then he did a great thing, which is he...
Can I just ask you, Graham?
Yeah.
Why was it free?
Because we thought that we... what was interesting was up until then, I had a trajectory as a hippie turning into a sort of punk, which was that, you know, the huge revolution in the 60s, which I was sort of, you know, old enough to take on and believe in. And then the whole political side of that. And you've got to remember there were things like the Angry Brigade were blowing up Biebers in fashion shops in London, and Baader Meinhof was going bazonkers in Germany, and Brigada Rosa in Italy were going. So I could see a trajectory of revolution and then moving into punk, that things were just going that way. So the whole free thing was the idea that money was going to, you know, that banks were going to dissolve and that money would become pointless and that we'd just exchange things with each other. And money was the root of all evil. So that was the planning behind it. And then that, you know, that we would then go and say to people at the end of the gig, if you think this is a good idea, can you give us some money to get to the next, pay for petrol to get to the next gig, and also to buy ourselves food and guitar strings and stuff. So that was the way it was done. We were asking people to donate rather than putting people on the spot. And also, of course, it was a perfect, without realising it, it was a perfect sell, because in those days, I would phone up social secretaries at the university and say, we want to come and put on something to entertain your students for nothing. And of course they said yes, you know, so we were doing like 30, 40 day tours up and down major venues. You know, we did things like Leeds University, where they did Live at Leeds, things like that. And of course, they didn't realise that we were.
What were the clubs getting? Because I remember seeing, well, the four with There and Now for the first time at small clubs, one in Liverpool,
Oldham, and things like that.
Oldham,
they would take the Tower Club, they would take it, and Eric's and things like that. They were just taking the bar.
Right. So was it, they
were quids in because they weren't having to pay any fee, you know.
Yeah. Mm. So was it economically viable then, just about? Or
it was, yeah. I had to run a very tight ship, and there were often moments where I was surrounded by like 14 very hungry band members and saying, no, we've got to save the money for the petrol fare, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it worked. I mean, we were all signing on, so in those days, you know, there was a little bit of money coming from us as well, but people would give us food and things like that.
Yeah.
I do remember one week where we literally lived for a week on homemade jam.
Christ.
There was no bread. That was a pretty story.
it's the rock and roll dream, that, isn't it? Writ large.
Who made the jam?
When you said you'd been on tour with the jam, I didn't know that was what you meant.
Would you like it? Like, yeah. We'll take the jam, man. But
that must have been a tricky sell to Mark E. Smith and Kay Carroll, that free gig malarkey.
Well, the whole thing was that they were so... I mean, the thing, you've got to remember that Mark and Kay were basically hippies, you know. I mean, as much as everyone wants to rewrite that thing, Mark had long hair, didn't he?
Yeah.
Kay, was a super hippie. What happened was, you know, Mark Perry played us the unreleased version, played me and Keith, the drummer from the Here and Now band, played us the unreleased. So we're going to put this out in a couple of months, see what you think. And it was, you know, Bingo Masters Breakout and Repetition.
Yeah.
And of course, in those heady days, having seen Bowie and then met him, having seen Gong and then become part of the band, and having seen Mark Perry and then got him to come on tour, so it seemed really obvious to go, oh, give us the phone number of that group before, and we'll phone them up and ask them if they want to do some gigs, you know.
Yeah.
Because the Fall weren't doing that many gigs then, you know. We were saying, you know, we can't pay you anything, but we've got a PA and I'll do the sound for it. And Kay and Mark was super.
Yeah.
Super friendly.
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly, I'm trying to think the first time I saw The Fall, I reckon it might have been some early 78. I think definitely they supported Susie and the Banshees at the Greyhound.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is a dreadful little gig. and they were brilliant and stunning. I can remember taking people down to see them. So whether I knew... whether it was just on the basis of Bingo Masters Breakout or whether I'd seen some gigs up north as well, I don't know. So I have some vague memory that it wasn't the first gig, but I know that for sure I saw that gig. And so, you know, I have no memory of what Susie did at all with the Banshees.
Yeah.
But just being completely blown away by The Fall, I just thought they were astonishing, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably... they still had that weird bass player...
Eric, I was just remembering that. Yeah, Eric was in the band. I think what they did, because I was at that gig, and I think what they did was a similar sort of thing. I think they hired a coach, charged a few people, you know, a fiver.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and me and Craig and Mark Riley were one of them, were three of them people, yeah.
I remember
going down.
That's
on a coach.
Right. There was a bit of people from up north.
Right.
Yeah.
How interesting, exactly what the Smiths did when I first saw the Smiths as well. They'd have a coach load of people coming down from Manchester to their gigs.
Right.
How weird is that?
Yeah.
What a weird, it goes round and round.
The Fall were on the coach.
Oh, really, as well?
Yeah.
Wow.
They're on the coach with the people, yeah.
Wow.
That's quite a good business model, that, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. So they get their coach and the transport free, and they...
Yeah.
People get to go to London and see the gig. Yeah.
Good idea.
And they, you know, they hadn't done that many gigs up till then, had they? I mean, they'd done maybe a couple in Manchester. You know, there wasn't a lot of... it wasn't like they were digging a lot. And so we were saying, OK, you know, we'll extend your reach.
Yeah.
And you won't have to pay a penny to do it, you know. And, Kay and Mark were totally up for it. Love their little hearts. And we were kind of, I suppose, Here and Now... if we had somewhere that was big, then one of our big places was Manchester. So we were in Manchester a lot of the time. So I got to, you know, go round to the flat really early on. And, you know, we were always eating it on the eighth day. I love that on the eighth day.
Still there.
Yeah, and then I guess by the end of 78, you know, somewhere towards, I don't think maybe the middle of 78, they started doing the Here and Now gigs with us, you know, right, for the fall. So,
and that's how you did the sound for the fall then, was it? That's how you
Yeah, because, nobody really got the fall, you know, they didn't understand it at all. And I was like, oh God, I totally understand this. This makes absolute sense to me, you know. It was a little bit like I felt that Carl had the structure and everyone else kind of diddled around him, you know, and as long as Carl kind of like finished the song, they all finished the song at the same time.
Yeah.
But it was, you know what it was like, Steve. It was astonishing, wasn't it? The Fall were astonishing.
Yeah.
They were so good live with it.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, Mark, it was almost like Mark had too many ideas, you know, he just trying to get them out.
Yeah.
So you were just in there being absolutely bamboozled by not only the words, but the music, because the music was so strange and weird.
Yeah.
And didn't seem to have any precedence. It wasn't punk thrash.
Not at all, no.
Not at all, no.
I don't know, you know, maybe thinking now, maybe it had a little bit of Television in it, all that spiky lines from Martin. But I mean, Martin was such an interesting guitarist, and even Paulette was such a fantastically strange keyboard player, you know, so it was all... I don't think I ever saw the original.
Una,
yeah, although I certainly met her, so maybe I did see her in the gigs. But I think
she didn't disappear when she left. She was obviously her and Martin were an item, so she was still hanging around even after she'd gone.
Maybe I just saw her hanging around.
It was a very friendly bunch in them. That's what Martin was saying. There was an interview with him recently. He said they were like a collective, weren't they? The Fall then.
Oh, it was. Yeah. No. I mean, the thing was because I think that lasted for a long time with you and Steve as well, Paul. Because I mean, I think that it was almost like you were pinching yourself that you were involved. You know, we were involved in this absolutely astonishing band. I mean, I was just like, oh my God.
Yeah, definitely.
Paul were talking about the last time when we were saying that, though, that the first time I met Mark, it was when we went to see The Passage, and it was the formed by the first ex bass player, and then they'd already gone through another keyboard player, and then they'd already gone through another bass player, two bass players, and why would you want to get involved with this?
Yeah, yeah, the writing was on the wall.
When they're going through so many musicians, why would you want to get involved with this? But we still did.
I know, but the thing was, I mean, how blessed were we? What would our lives be like? Astonished by it. Although at the time it just seemed really natural and just seemed for the next thing to do. And it wasn't as if the leaving, it didn't seem that traumatic, people leaving.
No,
to me.
Well, apparently, something I found out recently was Martin taught Craig how to play the songs.
I know, I saw that. Isn't that weird?
Isn't it?
There wasn't a lot of, you know, anger and...
No.
And, you know, I'm never talking to you again going on there. I mean, I seem to remember them, you know, you might, like you say, you'd see them at different, you know, you see them at the gigs as well. So, there you go.
Yeah. Martin came to see, when we played Rafters, just after I joined, Martin came and said he really enjoyed it. And I was like, this is Martin Brack, I couldn't believe it. And he was saying, I thought that was really good. But yeah, no, I think it was a lot friendlier then. They were like, because they were like a gang, weren't they, the original Fall?
No, absolutely. And it always felt like that. You know, it always felt like that. But then I suppose, I mean, pretty much, you know, you could say the same thing for Gong and you could say the same thing for Here and Now. I mean, it's one of those things where it's only afterwards that you realise how extraordinary all of that was, you know, because it just seemed like natural. It just seemed to be something that happened, you know.
Especially with the Fall, because there was no airs and graces or pretense of being anything that you weren't.
No, exactly. And also there was no, no one, it fitted in with the Gong, dare I say it, the Gong and the Here and Now thing. Because no one was trying to make an alternative TV as well. No one was trying to make it big.
No.
Not trying to have success. It was all about, and this sounds a bit po-paced, but it was all about creating art. You know, there was no career ideas about it. No, you know, I wasn't thinking, I mean, I thought the whole bloody world was going to end within the next 5 years. You know what I mean? The idea of having a career was...
No. Well, I mean, there was never an idea that it would last that... You know, that the fact that it kind of still astonishes me that it's still selling that stuff that we made in 1980. People are still buying it. I mean, the idea of that at the time was just nonsense, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, I always think back to... I mean, the thing about making Dragnet was, of course, you know, was one of Mark's absolutely crazy mad ideas, you know, literally an absolutely insane idea. I think sometimes he thought I'd made Gong albums or I'd produced Steve Hillage records or something. I don't know where all that came from. But because I was a sympathetic ear and I understood what they were doing, got me into do Dragnet. And, you know...
So you'd never produced in a studio before Dragnet?
I'd been in a studio and I'd had my opinions, but my opinions had been pretty much turned down because we'd made Give and Take by Here and Now then. And also I put out... And it was very much overridden by the studio engineer, anything I said.
Right.
And then not a lot of give and take then. Not a lot of give and take. Very little give and take at all. In fact, it was. Although I still speak to the engineer now. It's interesting. The water has gone under the bridge, and he's a nice guy. But and I'd also done the What You See Is What You Are split.
The live album with ATV.
With Alternative TV, which was just my live tapes.
Yeah.
Put onto a record. So I'd done a bit of stuff, but I didn't really, you know, I still don't really know very much. But, you know, that in that thinking that, you know, I think Mark paid me £200 for Dragnet.
Right.
That is literally, you know, maybe you didn't get paid that, Steve. But that was all the money I ever saw from Dragnet. And, you know, I travel the world and everywhere I go, Dragnet is for sale. I sort of think, oh, yeah, it's interesting. If I'd had a royalty on that,
yeah,
I wonder what it'd be like now. But just amazing that suddenly, again, I had a career and it's down to Mark. You know, Steve Hillage probably got me into the business, but Mark was the guy who gave, again, through a completely mad idea. And I've been at the wrong end, as I'm sure we all have, but at the wrong end of some of Mark's really mad ideas. But this particularly really mad idea, get Grant in to produce that second album, meant that suddenly my name was attached to a number one indie album as a producer. You know, and of course, clearly people love it, you know, the way it's... obviously... There are people who hate it, but there are people who've been trying to find me all their lives to make that record again, which of course I don't do. But
no,
it gave me because I would never have got involved with the Smiths without that, because Morrissey knew me because my name was on a full record.
Yeah,
and Johnny and Andy had been to Here and Now gigs in Manchester, so they'd seen me. As I used to do in those days, harassing
the
band.
You were doing the sound for us when they supported us, though, weren't you? I think.
Yes.
The Electric Ballroom.
That's right. Yeah, no, I did the sound for both of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So then you started up your own studio, didn't you, then, after Dragnet?
That's right,
You took that £200 and parlayed it into a state-of-the-art studio.
Yeah, it was a state-of-the-art studio. Do you remember the toilets?
There was a hole in the ground, I can remember. That's I don't remember an actual toilet.
A cement hole in the ground, wasn't it? That was another classic thing. You know, we were looking, myself and Keith. Keith had decided to leave the Here and Now band by then. We were, you know, you could see that everyone was releasing records by themselves. And also that, you know, there weren't a lot of studios that actually understood what was going on. So, and we clearly thought we did. So, yeah, with the help of Dave the Slave, who was a Here and Now roadie, we kind of built a studio in a squatted basement. That was just such a wonderful moment for me, because obviously having built this weird little studio, and having had the Dragneck experience, which had been a little bit like, okay, I'm somewhere else, and I've got a real, you know, almost Steve Albini-esque desire to make this record with as little reverb as possible and all the other things, and not use any studio trickery, to then suddenly build a studio and be able to start building the reverb. So I wanted to use the reverb because I built the bloody thing, it was a plate reverb, it was a metal sheet.
Yeah, yeah.
About 2 meters long by a meter tall.
Got an EMT?
Suspended on elastic bands, and then, you know, a microphone at one end and a speaker at the other. So, you know, insane. Yeah, such an easy thing to do. You know, I didn't know how those things were made. So to have got that, and then to squeeze you all into the room. Do you remember how small that room was?
Yes. I still have nightmares. Still get claustrophobia.
And there was no air conditioning or anything, was there?
No.
I think we did buy a sort of air conditioning unit that we kind of stuck somewhere, but I don't think we'd done it by the time we did it with you guys. But yeah, no, wonderful. 8-track, 2-inch tape. Oh, jumpers for goalposts.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the desk was in a van outside?
No, that's later on. That's what we call Street Love 2.
That's where we did Wings.
That's right.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah, getting them mixed up.
It's a long, long time ago, Steve. Mm. You know what I mean? The fact that, you know, we know who each other are I recognise you and know who you are. Yeah, and it's only because I built the fucking thing that I know it was like there. Yeah, no, we had it. Because it was a squatty building, and we turned up, and John the bicycle, who had the bicycle shop upstairs, we knocked on the door. We know you've got a basement downstairs that's not being used. And he said, yeah, have you got 500 quid? And we went, okay, yeah, I think we have got 500 quid. We went up and borrowed 500 quid, and it turned out that he was about to have his legs broken because he owed someone 500 quid. So that was it. We never paid any other rent at all. And I thought we were there for 2 years or 3 years.
Not good for somebody with a bicycle shop.
I'm not sure if he actually sold any bicycles. I mean, you know, squatted bicycle shop. I was never aware of any bicycles being sold, but at least it made, you know, it gave him something to do.
I'm desperately trying to think of something about was there a chain involved, but I can't quite.
You're backpedaling here.
Yes. Yeah. That's so funny. It's giving me the arm.
Oh God.
So we did. I think we did Pay Your Rates and Container Drivers in there.
That's right, absolutely. And I think that was it. I don't think we did anything else that was then missed off.
No, because what I remember about that is we did Container Drivers with you one day, and then we did it again the next day for Appeal Session.
Oh, wow, which is literally about 200 yards down the road from where the studio
is. That's right, yeah. Which is presumably was why we were booked into your place, is because we were doing the Appeal Session the next day.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
And as I say, the other thing I remember about Container Drivers is Mark had this nice little guitar solo, all worked out, Mark Riley. And, I mean, literally just before you pressed record, Mark said, Craig, you play the guitar solo instead. And he just had to make it up on the spot. And it is the weirdest guitar solo, that thing he plays in Container Drive. But it's great.
I still think, you know, Mark is great, but I also think that Craig is such an underrated guitarist. Really.
Oh, massively, yeah.
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 Does he play at all?
No one's asking the question, though, why did we just go along with that?
I mean, the thing was, I still thought in those days, you know, he was the genius and it all made sense. Do you know what I mean? I think there was it was later on that it became deranged, and then maybe in hindsight we realised that actually some of what he demanded or asked of us, because we were still the gang then, weren't we? It was still the gang. I remember it being the secret society of the Fall.
I think you were a bit of more of a crossbencher. For me, it was two gangs, really, if you see what I mean.
Well, it kind of got to that, didn't it? Especially in Australia and...
Well, yeah. I mean, but it was always a bit...
Later, right? Australia's later than that.
Yes,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
And what would you say were the two gangs, then?
Well, there was Mark and Kay, and usually A.N. Other. So it's very often you, or maybe Dave Tucker... sometimes, or maybe you and Dave Tucker. And Carl was always a bit a foot in both camps as well when he came along.
Carl, I think the thing, there was definitely a process where Carl became totally a Mark acolyte.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There was a process over the years.
Yeah, but he played that double agent thing very well, though. It was like he was your mate and silly.
He had no problem with slagging off Mark when he was with us, and presumably vice versa. But, I mean, it worked, didn't it? I mean, again, you read these many articles about the fall, and I start getting very conscious that it sounds like we're moaning all the time, which wasn't what it was, really, was it? It was great.
I mean, I still have absolute. I mean, I can remember the bad times, but the bad times for me really didn't kick in, I would say, until the 90s, you know. I really don't, you know, I can remember a time around cerebral cortex, whatever it's called, where things were pretty deranged. But up, and obviously I drifted in and out. I was a bit of a fanboy for quite a bit of the time, you know, post-Hex Induction Hour. But I don't remember it being horrible. I wanted to kill Carl quite a lot of the time.
That was part of his appeal.
He wanted to kill me, you know, so... Yeah.
No, I don't remember it as being horrible either. The only time it got really horrible for me was the pretty much the night I left. It was really grim. But I think...
Yeah, when was that?
That was at the end of 84. So we were really on the up then. We'd signed to Beggar's Banquet. There was money coming in.
The beginning of the Beggar's Banquet time.
Yeah. There was money coming
That's
in.
That's a really bad time to go, Paul.
It was stupid, absolutely stupid. It was mental, because I went to Mark at the beginning of the tour in 84, and I basically said to him, I'm a bit worried that if I stay much longer, I'm never going to do anything else, and this is never going to be my band. So I'm always going to... Which... And then he said, well, you're insane. And he was quite correct. I mean, why would you leave the fall to go and play in a crappy band with your mates? But that's what I did. And what happened was, I said that to him at the beginning of the tour, and he said, well, you're mental, don't do that. Stay the year and then see where we are then, because, you know, money's coming in, it's going to be great. And then we got to the end of the tour, and all the gear got nicked in Cardiff. I think it was in Cardiff. Oh, no, in Brighton, wasn't
it?
Right,
and it was your fault, wasn't it?
It was my fault, yeah.
It was in Cardiff, and then...
The band's fault. In fact, it was your fault, Steve, wasn't it?
Yes. It was my fault, yeah.
So then I thought, well, if I don't go now, I'm never going, because, you know, I've said I want to do something on my own, and if he's going to kick off this badly, if I don't go tonight, I will never go. So that was pretty much why I left.
I mean, in a way, I can see your thinking, because, you know, it was fairly easy, the full thing. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like meetings about, you know, the record deal and you've all got to dress a different way. And then things I've seen with other bands where they're like, you know, the record label's pressurising you to drop two of the band and we're gonna dress you, you know, we've got someone to dress you in these clothes.
We had all that.
Well, but that was once you got to that, was it? That was once you got to Beggars, right?
Yes.
No,
yes,
I mean, I remember... I mean, it happened a lot of the time throughout my time, but there was always seemed to be somebody trying to persuade Mark to go solo. Why are you paying these musicians that went to sit at home?
Really?
And you don't have... Yeah, from Jeff Travis to that guy who ran Trojan Records. He just couldn't understand why Mark was paying these musicians, yeah.
Wow. I never realised that. He just, I mean, obviously...
Who and I knew why.
Yeah.
There's no point in being Mark Smith without somebody to shout at, is there?
No, but I know what you mean about it being easy. I didn't have to think about anything being in the fall. There was huge swathes of what people think of being in a band that I would never went anywhere near me. I would never have dealt with a promoter. I never dealt with... you know, booking the Abbey Road for cutting a record or when to talk to... I never did any of that. And I thought, you know...
Well, that's what I'm saying. Certainly up to about... I mean, I would have thought from your perspective, I can see why you did it.
Yeah.
Because it's only in hindsight that I can see, you know, how remarkable the fact that the band even survived...
Yeah.
In a funny sort of way that the band survived to, like, you know, Slates.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then, you know, Hexing Butch, you know, so it seemed to me that, you could, and in a way, I think I, I mean, I think I've been lucky to carry on staggering along in that sort of way. You know, I never really bounced into any of that madness, but it was definitely, it did seem easy.
Yeah, definitely.
It seemed easy.
I mean, it's easy.
The thing is, Steve, you would know that the thing was, there must have been a point where you just stopped taking Mark seriously in the rant zone, right?
Yeah. But like you say, that in the 90s, yeah? That last 5 years I was in, it was awful. Awful.
I I can see. I can really see.
I remember bumping into you a few times in London and being like at the end of my tether with it all.
The 90s did seem, I mean, it was really, I think up to Curious Orange, it seemed like a fantastic, you know, like that was amazing, you know, to do that.
Yeah, and even after with Extra K, when Martin came back, that was great. But after that, it just went.
I was involved in Friends Experiment, and that seemed fine. I really liked Marsha. I thought Marsha brought a really interesting energy to the whole thing, and we were doing, you know, Markle Sinkers, and There's a Ghost in My House, and the Sergeant Pepper cover with Simon Rogers, and that all felt great. But yeah, once I got back to sort of, as I say, it was about 95 with Cerebral Palsy, which I think I was at some point, I think I almost made Cerebral Palsy, and then it was taken out of my hands, and only made some of my mixes were used. That felt awful, that one.
It was.
I mean, there's still some great stuff though. Like,
so, Gran, wanted to ask you what it was like. What was it like then after us? Then
I was going to get to that.
Yeah, is that too early to ask that?
Yeah, well,
what do you mean after you guys left?
It was
really weird. It was really weird. I mean, because the Unutterable, they'd done some stuff, and it was really basically me and
Julia.
That's right. It's me, Julia, and Mark. And Mark was pretty gone by then.
But I mean,
so.
It's Dr. Book's letters.
I mean, I saw the other musicians, but I mean, they were certainly, the guitarist was a very damaged person, and Tom Head kind of was very cynical about it and didn't ever have that gang.
Yeah,
the gang mentality had kind of gone by then, I think. You know, people knew they were in for a couple of, and Mark was. It was kind of. And Mark felt lost, you know.
Yeah.
Really. He felt lost.
Well, he kind of...
I mean, you've got to admire it. Because when I left, I thought that was... There's no way it was going to carry on.
Oh, yeah. No, insane. I mean, you know, there is something... you know, they just found that sea slug that you can cut its head off. And the head, head carried on living, and the body carries on living for a little bit. But then the head grows another body, and they can't work out how it happens. Mark was a little bit like that. He
like
had his head off on several occasions, you know.
But that was when you said the guitarist, was that Ben Pritchard? Was it his first record?
No, Ben is Are You Are Missing Winner, isn't he? I think. The Unutterable was the Welsh guy who turned up at the funeral and tried to steal a bottle of whiskey and was caught by Pamela.
Oh, that sounds like a nice guy.
Yeah, it sounds like a lovely guy. I thought he was Dave Bush as well, so I really blotted my copybook going up to him saying, are you Dave Bush? He's like, no, I'm surly, nasty guitarist who hates you.
it's not a small list, that, though, is it, to be fair? But having said that, Dr. Book's letter is brilliant. It's one of the best things I think The Fall ever did, isn't it?
Oh yeah, no, it's stunning. I mean, the thing was, you know, in classic fashion, he hadn't done the words, so I had basic tracks of most of them had been done before I turned up. But I then decided to add a lot of keyboards from Julia. Because it was a dance studio, and really Mark wasn't focused enough to kind of really be able to understand what was going on. But he, and I was, and because I love I have to say that my starting point for The Fall is Mark's words, you know, so I'm in love with that book.
Of course.
And so I was just coaxing out as much stuff as I could. And so that The Unutterable was the last record I ever made with Mark where he didn't then come and fuck it up afterwards. Every other record I made after that with him, and I made another three.
Well, what about Imperial Wax Sovereign? That's a great album.
Yeah, but have you heard my version?
I don't think I have, no. Is it better?
It's called the Britannia Road Sessions.
Okay.
What they did was they kept my vocal comps. So that was the thing, because I loved Mark's words, because, you know, to a lot of people, it just didn't make sense. And so they didn't know, they couldn't tell where, you know, where Senseless Madness started and Inspired Genius stopped. So they literally, a lot of the time, I think on the records I'm not involved with, there's kind of unedited and unloved kind of vocals. And I always think about Miles Davis in his later period, where they were taking things like Ted Maceo, right, something like that, was the producer or engineer, and he did things like, I think on Bitches Brew, like he took a solo and then dropped it in four or five times and made it a chorus,
right,
in the song, you know, as a motif.
Yeah,
and so I felt I was doing that with Mark's vocals. I was taking ideas he might only have done once and saying, actually, this is brilliant. And, you know,
but I find
it was like that. Yeah. The shards kind of wouldn't coalesce, but I could get the shards to coalesce, to use one of his lyrics. I could see what he was trying to do.
Right.
And what they did with Imperial Wax Solvent, I think, is they took my vocal comps, which made sense largely, and then redid all the music or went back to, I don't know what they did. I mean, it was, you know... Okay. I mean, I'm really proud of Imperial Wax as Solvent, and I'm also really excited about the fact that my version of Remix, which has got like six songs they didn't use, you know, coming out. So, you know,
is it coming out? I was just going to ask you that. Will any of this stuff see the light of day then?
Well, Imperial Wax Solvent has been released with, although I'm not even sure if I get a mention on the bloody, the Britannia Rose Sessions. But that, the Britannia Rose Sessions are, I can't quite work out if they're rough mixes or if it's actually the final cut. Someone got the final cut that I made, because it was that classic thing, you know, where I had to go to Australia and I was like, Mark, this is a brilliant record. Really don't fuck it up. Please, please don't fuck it up. Don't do something stupid. Because he'd done that to the Real New Fallout, right? So I'd done it as Country on the Click.
All right.
And then he'd gone back and I thought made a much worse record. Because there's a really psychedelic version of the Real New Fallout album.
Yeah.
Which is it's kind of follows on from Unutterable. I'm using lots of keyboards. And I suspect that the drummer is playing the keys because Eleanor wasn't capable of playing those keyboards because she was never really a great keyboard player. And again, hopefully that will come out at some point or other, because I really like those records, and I put my heart and soul to them. And but yes.
Yeah, it would be a shame.
Britannia Rose Sessions, look them out.
I will, yeah.
Yes.
Listen to the guitars going through the Leslie speakers. I mean, wow. I just did so many amazing, beautiful things on that, you know, you can listen to that. You can listen to the Britannia Rose Sessions over and over again and hear more and more stuff, because I really layered it.
Right, because then I was going to say that, because some of the stuff on there, like that Wolf Kid Up Man, is that on there? That's what a riff, that is. That is such a. That is the riff.
Fantastic. But on my version, there's kind of backwards guitars and Leslie guitars and all sorts of... The riff doesn't start at the very beginning and then play all the way through.
Right.
Sometimes it comes halfway through. There's builds in it, you know.
Did you do Can Can Summer then? Was that you?
Yeah, I did Can Can Summer, yeah.
That sounds like five different Fall songs stuck together, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it was an interesting time because it was the first time for the band, and I was having to sort of in a funny sort of way, I was having to be the Fall head. Do you know what I mean? Because I think.
Well, yeah, I was going to say it sounds like you did a lot more than just produce it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, they were the first time in the studio as a band. And
so what band was that? What lineup was on?
That is the Lads. That is, you know, that's the band that went on forever.
Yeah,
they could. You know, for whatever it is, 9 years, isn't it? Nine years they did. Or even longer, 9 years. Wow. And I think, in a way, he'd done full Heads role and Reformation, which, you know, sounded like they were stuck. I'm not sure how foolish those records are, because it sounds like the band aren't fitting in with the full imprint. But I thought by Imperial Wax Sultan, I thought I brought it back a little bit.
Definitely.
More back.
Yeah, because look,
there is blindness, though. That's
Blindness is amazing. Yeah, it's where is that? That on Reformation?
No, it's on Fall Heads Roll, isn't it? Because it's Steve Trafford who plays with us.
Yeah. No, I like Steve Trafford. You know, I made that record that never came out with them after Fall Heads Roll Reformation. There was a great record made, you know.
Well, who's got that? Who's got the tape of that then?
It'll turn up. These things always turn up. Someone's got them somewhere.
Well, considering some of the shit that's been released, you would think that if there's a properly recorded set of songs, someone would want to put them out.
Yeah, I think they're mainly instrumental from my memory of it.
Ah, right. I mean, it wouldn't take too much of a leap for someone to do, like, you know, they did with The Doors and American Prayer, that kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. Take Panzer or something like that and do it.
Yeah.
Something like that with Rex around about
Rex.
I wanted poor Rex around about. Well, you didn't know Rex, did you?
I knew him. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I knew him well. Yeah, we toured.
This is Rex. Rex Sargent. We're talking about it.
Know what happened? Poor guy. I did a remix around about, I want to say, Middle Class Revolt. We did something with some sort of discarded vocals. I've got that somewhere and put some sort of, you know, it was because it was all in that dancey mode. And I was going over to his studio because he was living in a house that had a studio in the basement. And I'd go over there and do some stuff with him. And we did that. We took some sort of verbals that hadn't been used and everything and threw them onto a dance mix. I was, you know, I wasn't entirely happy with it, but it was fun to do.
Yeah, you could see somebody enterprising with doing it, couldn't you? It's definitely there to be done.
Oh, I mean, that is definitely true with Mark's vocals. You probably, you know, you can, because I was moving them around and putting them into different places at times. You can do that. I did find that was possible with Mark's stuff, you know.
Yeah, I find that amazing, to be honest, because that is so far removed from my experience of Mark with his vocals when I was in the band, that he took so much care over what went where, and, you know, you'd have two or three vocals going in. That was his big thing, wasn't it? Making sure that he got... I mean, sometimes you could argue there's too many words on some things, but...
As I say, I always feel like he had... You know, that was the amazing thing with Mark at a certain point, was you're like, oh, my God, you know, he's got so much stuff going on, particularly in the live performance. He's like, and you feel like he's thinking four lines ahead, but he's got like eight different improvisations in between that line and the next, you know.
Well, if you listen to that album that's just come out, that is exactly that one from 1981.
On fire.
Yeah, I mean, I used to think sometimes some of the stuff he said between songs that off the top of his head were better lyrics than most bands that ever have in a million years, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I mean, as you say, there are things that... What is amazing is he kept coming up with the goods despite being, you know, the fact that he was, you know, he managed to not die earlier.
Yeah.
And even despite, I mean, I think there are, you know, I think if you listen to Levitate and Are You Our Missing Winner, which I know some, you know, awkward people sort of say, oh, they're the greatest Fall albums, but they just sound like someone who's utterly lost, you know, and it's like that Big Star third album, you know, or something like, I mean, I remember when I was younger, I loved the Syd Barrett albums, you know, and I was like, oh, this is great, you know, he's completely fucked and he doesn't know what's going on and he's saying, I went back and listened to those Syd Barrett albums and they're terrifying, you know, in some respects.
They're not, I think they're uncomfortable listening. They're not, it's like I shouldn't be listening to this in some ways.
Yeah, and I feel like that about Levitate and Are You Our Missing Winner, you know, I just feel like they're, that is what happened in, and to some extent maybe cerebral palsy, but that's what happens when there's no one helping him and he's in a mess, you know. Yeah. And I don't know, so, you know, I'm again, vocally, I'm a little bit, once the growling starts, again, he's doing so, I mean, it must be so hard. It must have been so hard. And you can see the agony of being the genius vocalist and then, you know, being this insanely great vocalist. And then, you know, it's like I did that in 1981, but I've got to do it in 1991. I've got to do it in 2001. I've got to do it in 2011. And you feel that, you know, the whole hiding the words by growling.
Yeah.
And then the concertining of the words, so there's less, you know, reformation is like, you know, if, a lot of reformation is four phrases repeated over, you know, over and over again. And you're like, oh, God, he's, and then you're sort of thinking, oh, is he doing it because he can't remember the words anymore? And is he having to make it simpler because he just cannot follow? I did some of that, you know, I kept coming back and doing gigs, and I began, there were times when Mark felt completely lost.
Yeah.
With it back, you know what I mean? He's doing it early on when you guys are in the band, but he's kind of, it's happening some of the time, whereas later on, I mean, I understand all the genius and I still loved it and I saw gigs, you know, through the, you know, the 2010s onwards that I loved, you know, but there was an element of like disguising and editing down because, you know, he had such a body of work to live up to.
Yeah. But the amazing thing about that is he could have stopped, couldn't he? He could have stopped playing live.
Well, I don't think... I think that people overestimate how many records he was selling.
Right.
And think that he was probably living... And also, I mean, thinking about it, I was thinking about this with the Real New Fool album. I was like, the amount of money he spent making it sound shit. and I was sort of doing, thinking... You know, he can't be making any money back. You know, he had that very odd deal with Minder Music, his publishing company, which they, you know, they signed. I think
tell us about it.
It's fun, you know.
Yeah.
Certainly around about the time of... I think they did it around the time of Container Drivers and Pay Your Rates, even. So maybe
We did, yeah. It was a terrible deal for the band.
And he never got off it. It's always on it. And I think they were living... I think he needed to do the gigs to get the cash in.
Right. Okay.
And in a way, I mean, some of the things that Mark did, you know, like never becoming computer savvy and never having a mobile phone, never learning to drive, that, you know, he began to be isolated and people around him that did understand those things perhaps took advantage of that, you know, at times. And,
right. No names.
But, you know, it's a stance, again, that in some respects was valid, but also, as I say, probably I felt like he should have made more money than he did.
Yeah.
And he should have been more comfortable than he was.
Yeah. I sort of like to think that with them lads at the end, he was happy doing that. And for them to last as long as he did, it must have been okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, he did refer to them as his boys. You know, they never had any kids. They were younger.
Yeah.
And there was an element of, like, after the show, they would often, you know, I spent nights up with him, you know, with us all together, just having a laugh, you know.
Yeah.
So once that, obviously, you know, I think people underestimate how concerned he was about the performance. Now, he might, out of being, you know, obviously having a drink and drug problem, I think we can safely say Mark had that, and certainly towards the end, you know, it wasn't helping him. But it was all to do with putting on a good show. He never wanted to put on a shit show. So he was wound up and worried and concerned about shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards, the release, the serotonin release of, like, I've got through the show and, you know, no one's, you know, we've got the money and we're back at the hotel room and the lads are having a great time because, you know, obviously it was amazing for them.
Yeah.
You know, to be in this position of having, you know, played to not a lot of people and people not listening to you, to suddenly play to a lot of people and to have a lot of people caring about you. It would have been, you know, it's it was, it's a repeat of what happened with you guys. Do you know what I mean? Taken from... You couldn't imagine somebody being like, oh God, we're this amazing band. We're part of this legend. You know, you created the legend. But they stepped into their into those shoes, did a pretty damn good job of it, I think.
Definitely, yeah. I think it was healthier. The lines were drawn where everybody knew where they stood. I think by then there wasn't any pretension of, I mean, any idea of it being like a band in the sense that it was as much you as anybody else. I don't think they ever needed that or expected that, did they? They knew that they were working for Mark in a way, which is a healthy thing, I think.
Yeah, and also I think that there was, they went into it with their eyes open. I suspect they perhaps didn't take Mark's instructions as seriously perhaps as we did.
I think
we listened to, because Mark had got, you know, had created this thing and we were part of this amazing thing, and we could see, you know, that it had gone from, you know, a flat without a fridge to this kind of like amazing legend. We kind of followed what Mark was doing, and perhaps we followed it a little bit too closely. Do you know what I mean, Steve? I felt like
we were
listening to it when we should have just gone, yeah, you're right, it should be more purple, and then just carried, look, I'm playing it more purple.
Carried on playing it like a snake.
Yeah.
It wasn't, to be fair, he did play it very much like a snake after he had that instruction. You can hear the snake-like nature of the whatever it was he was playing. But yeah, I think that's true, I think. But then
I think you can see it, you know, you can see it. There's an you know, the more I read about Beefheart, the more I realise that, you know, that in a way that happened, you know, those last albums that he made, you know, the band, obviously the Troutmars Replica Band was starving, and, you know, he was transposing songs which had three different key changes from a piano improvisation that Beefheart could never do again. And then later on, they still make those great records, Ice Cream for Crow and all those things. But you've got the feeling the band are like going, actually, we know what to do now. Play it like an envelope being swallowed by a seal, but you know that I know what to do.
Yes,
I you know, we've got a format, and I know what to do.
You don't want a format, though, do you? A lot of the time, if you know what I mean.
No,
I don't think it ever became. It might have been a format, but I don't think the fall ever became formulaic, did they?
Well, I'm wondering if those, I don't know. I felt like through the maybe the last. Your future act clutter, Erzex, GB, sublingual tablet?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And New Facts. I felt those had a similarity to them.
Right.
That perhaps, you know, obviously it's my perspective. I always think that my version of Imperial Wax, my version of Remix, which eventually will, I think the Britannia Rose sessions is as close to my version of Imperial Wax Solvent as has gone out, and then my version of Remit will eventually, I'm sure, pop its head up. I think they step outside that, and I'm rather proud of the fact that they've done that. And, you know, I just feel like I had, you know, I just felt like.
And did he ever give you any reasons why he changed it all?
No.
Well, I mean, it's still pretty incredible when you think about it, that a band that lasted that long, you could still talk about changing up the formula and making things. I mean, most bands who've lasted that long are basically just... not that there is that many bands who lasted that long, but the idea of them doing something original away from the formula after that long is just... It's laughable, isn't it?
Yeah. No, hats off to them. I always admired all three of the guys, and I've seen Imperial Wax since, and they're pretty damn hot, you know.
I'd really like to see them, actually.
Yeah, no, they're definitely worth a view. Definitely worth a view, because they kind of... I think they do a better version of what they do now as Imperial Wax than they did as The Fall, actually, to be honest with you.
Well,
you know.
Right.
Thanks for joining us for episode 2 of Old Brother. Episodes are released every second Wednesday, so look out for episode 3. Please follow us on Twitter at Old Brother Show, where you can subscribe via iTunes or link to Spotify, so you'll never have to miss an episode. If you feel like rating us on iTunes, that'd be lovely too, or at least tell your mates how good it was. If you're interested in hearing more from me and Steve, you might want to check out our books, The Bid Midweek and Have a Bleeding Geth, both available from Root Publishers and all good bookstores. See you back here soon, and remember, if you're driving, take your car.